Hello, this is Stephanie with the reading of the Panagraph for Tuesday, June 20th, 2017. Our first article from the front page is Library Board Favors Expanding Current Site. When it comes to the location of an expanded or new Bloomington Public Library, the City Council apparently favors keeping it at its current location. In a straw poll during a joint meeting Monday of the Council and Library Board of Trustees, 7 of the 9 aldermen and Mayor Tari Renner voiced support for keeping the library at 205 East Olive Street on the southeast edge of town. "Just to be clear, I'm not prepared to say I'm endorsing everything else," said Ward 2 Alderman David Sage, referring to other issues, such as funding a library construction project. Library officials have estimated, based on 2017 construction season costs, that construction could cost $30 million to $39 million, depending on the option chosen, but funding was not discussed Monday. The feedback we received tonight was an affirmation of our board's consensus, Library Board President Alex Cardona said after the meeting. Ward 4 Alderman Amelia Burgess opted for moving the library closer to the heart of downtown to ensure, she said, that the library project and downtown revitalization both remain priorities that may share the same funding pool. Ward 1 Alderman Jamie Matthey agreed with Burgess, adding that he also would accept expanding at the current location. Completed in 1977, the two-story library sits on about 2.5 acres across East Street from City Hall and the Bloomington Police Department. To the south and southwest are several Public Works Department facilities, including a maintenance garage and a collection site for garbage dropped off by residents. At a special meeting in May, the Library Board came to the same consensus it reached in 2015, despite a subsequent change in the board's membership since then and a push by some aldermen to move the library to a new location. "We think the most prudent thing for the community is to stay here," said Cardona. "We want to be a catalyst project for this part of southeast downtown." Library Director Jean Hamilton provided rough numbers indicating a total cost of $30.4 million for renovating the existing building, building an addition, and paving a parking lot. Constructing a new library on city-owned property south of the current library and with a new parking lot would raise that figure to $39.3 million. Both estimates do not include additional buildings such as a parking deck depicted in a campus-type setting proposal in earlier conceptual site plans by the Farnsworth Group. In 2015, the trustees hired the architectural firm at $80,500 to conduct a study for the library's expansion at its current location and provide three conceptual site plans. Hamilton estimated conservatively that about $2 million in private donations could be raised. She also estimated that to pay off a 30-year bond, the owner of a $165,000 home could see a tax bill increase of $18 each year over the life of the bond. If no expansion or renovation occurs, about $2 million in Band-Aid repairs to the existing building will need to be made, said Hamilton. That expenditure would not address the current library's lack of space for its collection of 318,417 books, DVDs, and other physical items, and the growing number of people attending library programs, she added. "It sounds like we have good support," said Hamilton after the meeting. "We still have the financial question out there, but we're excited to move forward and do some planning for the future. The Library Board will discuss the issue Tuesday." The next article is Council Questions Allowing Felons on Police Review Board. Bloomington City Council members appear to favor creating a civilian oversight board for public safety services, but whether felons could serve appears to be a sticking point. The Council, which is expected to vote next month on the creation of the Public Safety and Community Relations Board, discussed the issue in a non-voting work session Monday night that drew an audience of about 100 people, most of whom favor the concept. While none of the council members openly opposed creating the board, several expressed concerns about the makeup of what is expected to be a 7-member commission. "I am more conflicted than I have been on any other decision I have made on this council," said Ward 5 Alderman Joni Painter, addressing the audience. "At the beginning, I was all for it," Painter said. "I realize there is a national problem with people trusting the police, and there have been horrible things that have happened, and I think it's really good that we tackle those things on a local level. I was with you up until the deal where you want people who have been convicted criminals to serve on this board, and you are so adamant about it, and that makes no sense to me at all." Bloomington resident Sonny Garcia, who addressed the council prior to the discussion, said felony convictions should have no bearing on the makeup of the board. I am concerned that we are leaving many people out, people like me, behind, due to the pervasive narrative that cuts out people with past felony convictions, he said. We can be a part of positive growth in our community. As part of a compromise, Ward 9 Alderman Kim Bray suggested putting in restrictions defining how felonies would affect someone's eligibility to serve. I think an option might include a time frame, such as no felony convictions in the past 7 years, so that indiscretions of youth aren't held against someone forever, she said. After taking a non-binding straw poll, Mayor Tari Renner interpreted the results as showing 6 of the 9 aldermen favoring some sort of compromise on the issue of members with felony records. I don't want to see a convicted killer on the board, but only for the grace of God do I probably not have something on my record from earlier days, and I just didn't happen to be at the right place at the wrong time, said Ward 8 Alderman Diana Howman. Leaders of several local organizations have expressed support for creating the board. They include the ACLU of Central Illinois, Black Lives Matter Bloomington Normal, Bloomington Normal branch of the NAACP, Not in Our Town Bloomington Normal, YWCA McLean County, Central Illinois Pride Health Center, Prairie Pride Coalition, Illinois People's Action, and the McLean County League of Women Voters. The board could do more than just evaluate public complaints about the police department, said Ward 7 Alderman Scott Black. This will create an avenue to address concerns and turn positive things into reality, he said. I think it's a solution that is the best fit and can be a positive influence on the community. Council members said the board and its procedures could be altered once it has been operating for some time. I see it as taking about 6 months to identify the people for the board, get it up and running, and then let them do a year of actual work before we come back and reevaluate how it's working, Howman said. The next article is headlined, Normal Picks Underpass for Uptown Crossing. In what one member called a 25-year decision, the Normal City Council picked an underpass as the preferred option for an Uptown Station railroad crossing Monday, putting the controversial project on track to be built. Members voted 5-2 to stop studying all crossing options except building an underpass or using existing crossings at Broadway Avenue and Linden Street to move Amtrak passengers, pedestrians, and Constitution Trail users between the station and the proposed Uptown South District. Members cited safety, accessibility, and aesthetics among their reasons for choosing the underpass with attached park, a decision backed by the majority of public commenters and by the consultant conducting the study, New York City-based WSP Parsons Brinkerhoff. Members Kathy Lawrence and Scott Preston voted no on narrowing the study to the underpass. Both said they were not convinced an underpass is the only viable option for the crossing. The consultant presented 7 options, including doing nothing and building various types of overhead crossings and underpasses, and the most expensive of those was the underpass with a park. I was looking for either a more definitive answer for one or at least an acknowledgement that there could be more than one that was viable for further study, Lauren said. Could we look at a top 2 or a top 3 without putting all of our chips on one number? WSP Parsons Brinkerhoff will now do an environmental study and preliminary design work on an underpass and a no-build plan, including detailed cost estimates. That work is expected to be finished next fall. Members stressed that choosing to study the underpass doesn't mean it will be built. Once the study is finished, the town will use it to solicit state or federal grant funding, without which the project is impossible, said Mayor Chris Koos. Koos said those factors make the current lack of detailed cost estimates less significant. Normal's 2014 Uptown 2.0 plan, which first recommended building an underpass, listed it at $12.7 million and an overpass at $8.6 million. There's a lot of unknowns at this stage, said Bruce Nelson, a project manager at WSP Parsons Brinkerhoff. We don't know what steel prices are going to be in 2 years. We don't know what labor prices are going to be. That's all going to come out in preliminary engineering. Mark Tiratilli, a frequent critic of town spending who lost to Koos in the April 4th election, told the council the town could do the project better without jumping through hoops for federal funding. The current study, a $1.4 million expense, was intended to satisfy federal grant requirements, and City Manager Mark Peterson said Monday an underpass is more likely to get federal money than an overpass. We've got a state that can't keep our schools open, can't keep our buses running. We've got a federal government that's $20 trillion in debt, Tiratilli said. We need to do our part to help reduce this budget crisis at all levels. It's all our money. Councilmember Kevin McCarthy said the town has an obligation to get our money back and spend it in our own community. It's incumbent on us to bring as much value from the federal government back to our community as we can, said Coos. Councilmember Jeff Fritzen dismissed the idea that the council effectively decided on an underpass 2 years ago when it voted to abandon an overpass project that already had grant funding in favor of studying an underpass. He said Monday an attractive overpass could still be a good option. The reason this community has been so successful, and that includes with Uptown, is we take times to do things the right way, or upon discovering that they're not feasible, they're not possible, then we don't do them, said Councilmember R.C. McBride. That takes research. Moving now to the local section, the first article is Arson Dog Maisie Shows Off Her Skills at BFD. As a trained fire investigator with the Illinois State Fire Marshal's Office, Shane Art knows that when he sees a thick plume of smoke or reads a news report about a major fire, he might as well start heading to the scene. Showing up alone, though, isn't enough. There's little point in going if his new four-legged companion, Maisie, isn't there. Maisie, a certified arson dog, is a 4-year-old yellow Labrador who has been trained to sniff out accelerants used to start fires. Both were on hand Monday at the Bloomington Fire Department training site for a demonstration. If arson is suspected, we can go through a house in about 5 to 10 minutes, Arndt said. During the demonstration, which included an indoor and outdoor scenario, officials placed a few drops of accelerant for Maisie to find. After an initial walkthrough of the area, Maisie went to work, and once she found the accelerant, she stopped, came to a sit position, and pointed her nose in the direction of the accelerant. It's what is called a passive alert. Our local fire districts and municipalities depend on us and our investigators to assist with investigations, said State Fire Marshal Matt Perez. We couldn't do it without the arson dogs. The program was established in 1993 through the sponsorship of State Farm, and over the past 24 years, more than 380 teams have been trained and placed in 45 states, the District of Columbia, and Canada. State Farm continues to sponsor the program. It costs about $25,000 to purchase the dog and train the dog and handler. The canines are all Labrador Retrievers or Goldadors, Lab and Golden Retriever mix, because they have a superior ability to discriminate scents at a fire scene. Labs also have a good disposition and an outgoing personality, said Heather Paul, a public relations specialist with State Farm. They are very active and have a love-to-work type of attitude. Canines like Maisie are trained through a food reward method, Arndt said. They only eat from the hand of their handler while training or working. They live and retire at the home of their handlers. For Arndt, Maisie is the fourth dog he's worked with. On Monday, he also brought Rusty, a 10-year-old chocolate lab, who recently retired. Rusty is just beginning to learn to eat from a bowl, which is very different than what he has done his entire life, Arndt said. But Maisie is the first female I have worked with, and so it's going to be interesting to see what differences there are. The canines and handlers are required to complete 200 hours and 4 weeks of training by the Maine State Police before they are qualified for investigations. They are required to be recertified every year to maintain a certified accelerant detection canine team. The benchmark is 100% accuracy, Arndt said. Even with today's sophisticated equipment available for detectives, Arndt said he prefers the accuracy of the trained dogs. I trust arson dogs more because I have worked with them for years, he said. Just because she might alert at a fire, though, doesn't necessarily mean that it is an intentionally set fire. We still have work to do. We have to determine what it was she picked up on and investigate that portion of it. But the dogs are a great tool and can point us in the right direction. There are 7 arson dogs working with the State Fire Marshal's Office. Now from the crime and court section, plea deal reached in Twin City theft case. A Bloomington man pleaded guilty Monday to stealing more than $600,000 from 2 investors in a plea agreement that could send him to prison for 15 years. Derek Gordon, 44, accepted a prosecution plea offer as a bench trial on 20 felony counts was set to begin in McLean County Circuit Court. He pleaded guilty to theft by deception, money laundering, forgery, and wire fraud. The state amended the most serious charge, lowering the amount of money taken to $499,999 to allow Gordon to be eligible for probation when he is sentenced August 21st. Gordon also agreed to pay $524,859 to Ron Briscoe and $100,000 to Richard Jackson, two investors who lost their money after turning money over to Gordon to invest in a hedge fund. Losses of a third investor, Frank Lunn, who allegedly lost $200,000 in the sunken fund, were not part of the restitution listed in the plea agreement, but may be considered during sentencing, said First Assistant State's Attorney Adam Grist. Defense lawyer Chris Graham said his client was initially in favor of a bench trial because the whole story would be told. It would come out that he did not steal the investors' money in the true sense of the word. The defense claims the losses were the result of highly volatile stock market conditions between 2012 and 2013. Gordon admitted to engaging in illegal activity to hide the losses, including the creation of false financial reports. The cover-up was much worse than the underlying crime from our perspective. When you're faced with these large losses, it's hard to face people. That was Derek's undoing, said Graham, who estimated that Gordon illegally pocketed less than $10,000. In his statement to support the plea, Grist detailed a 3-year scheme by Gordon that started with the investment from Lunn that dwindled to a $6,000 value within 2 months in late 2012. In January 2013, Briscoe cashed out his retirement and handed out over between $100,000 and $500,000 to Gordon's Cornerstone Genesis Fund, said Grist. Gordon told the new investor that his contribution was the smallest in the fund that was actually worth less than $6,000 at the time, said the prosecutor. In September 2014, Gordon told Jackson of multi-millions he was trading within this hedge fund that had one other investor. The state alleged that investors were not told of the 18% to 20% brokerage fees charged to their accounts by a firm that did not involve Gordon. When questions surfaced from investors in 2014, Gordon began to shift money within the accounts and produce false statements and emails in an effort to show the fund was making money. Briscoe was told in December 2014 that his investments were worth almost $1 million, when in fact the fund had a value of about $5,500, according to evidence from the state. The risks associated with the hedge fund were spelled out in documents signed by the victims, who all work in the financial sector, said Graham. State's Attorney Jason Chambers credited the Illinois Securities Department with providing the expertise to help put the complex case together, adding that the devastating financial impact such cases can have on individuals and businesses justifies the effort. We hope that by doing so, it will send the message that it is not worthwhile or risk-free to commit a crime like this, and it will hopefully encourage victims to come forward on future cases as well, said Chambers. Next story. Woman faces felony DUI in husband's death. An East Peoria woman is charged with aggravated driving under the influence of alcohol in the death of her husband, who died following a crash Friday morning on Interstate 55 near Bloomington. Juanita Webster, 40, was in McLean County Circuit Court on Monday to face charges that accuse her of being intoxicated and behind the wheel when emergency responders were called to the single vehicle crash. Killed in the accident that occurred shortly before 6:30 a.m. was Andre Webster, the driver's 37-year-old husband. Witnesses told police the defendant was driving erratically before the accident, according to a prosecutor's statement given to a judge Saturday. The woman's blood alcohol content was 0.164, more than twice the legal limit for intoxication in Illinois, according to the prosecutor. An autopsy indicated the victim died of blunt force head and neck injuries suffered in the crash, according to the McLean County Coroner's Office. During her brief court hearing, conducted via a video link with the McLean County Jail, Webster told Associate Judge Bill Yoder she needed to be taken to the hospital. But she showed no obvious signs of injury and got up and walked from the room after the hearing. Webster was jailed in lieu of posting $50,035. A July 7th arraignment is scheduled. Husband charged after fight over Father's Day meal. An argument over the quality of a Father's Day meal led to a physical altercation and criminal charges against a normal man, according to the suspect's comments Monday to a McLean County judge. "She just got mad at me after I said the food she cooked for Father's Day was salty," 36-year-old Achilles McClellan told Associate Judge Bill Yoder. McClellan is charged with aggravated domestic battery for allegedly punching his pregnant wife in the face and choking her during a dispute Sunday at the couple's home in the 600 block of North Linden Street in Normal. Officers who responded noted signs that the suspect was intoxicated, according to the prosecutor's statement read in court. McClellan also is charged with interfering with the reporting of domestic violence for allegedly hanging up the phone while his wife was seeking help from police, said prosecutors. McClelland later called police and reported he had been injured, said the prosecutor's statement that noted police saw scratches on him. Criminal damage to property charges against him are related to damage to a bedroom door. McClelland was jailed in lieu of posting $3,035. A July 7th arraignment is scheduled. Now from the opinion page, here are the letters to the editor. The first one, politics needs more civility, respect. Last fall, after the election, I was invited to the Twin City Elected Officials Unity Rally, where I said the following. We strive to maintain a posture of civility and that we have to operate with the understanding of agreeing to respectfully disagree. The election is over. There will be future elections. I finished by quoting President Lincoln by saying we must appeal to the better angels of our nature. The democratic process requires that when a party or your candidate loses an election, you individually or through your party can work to win hearts and minds so that your candidate or cause can win future elections. As individuals, one can strongly disagree with another candidate, one can work against another candidate, but physically harming your political opponent is not an option. An individual should not dehumanize and demonize a candidate and/or elected official because the unbalanced individual uses it to devalue the candidate and/or elected official as a human being. If you are at a point where you cannot value the candidate and/or elected official that you politically oppose as a human being, then please get help. No one is perfect, but we all have value as human beings. President Lincoln, who presided over a contentious time in our history, appealed to the better angels of our nature when he said, "We are not enemies, but friends. We must not be enemies. Though passion may have strained, it must not break the bonds of affection." Signed, Chuck Erickson, Bloomington. The writer is a McLean County board member. Next letter. Committee should consider training. During August 1995, the Normal Police Department offered a course for citizens to learn about operations of the department. In the class I attended were about 20, mostly males, held at the department's headquarters. We were given an overall view of the department's organization and functions. Memorable for me was a demonstration of how an officer handcuffs a suspect during an arrest, including a description of how to deal with a suspect resisting arrest. We were given a demonstration of how the department's dog, trained in German, identified marijuana in a small container, and how the dog, on command, apprehended a suspect, played by another officer wearing a thick padded sleeve on his arm. At the start, we were encouraged to ride with an officer on patrol during all three shifts, day, eve, and midnight. We were to remain in the car and observe. At the next meeting, those who rode reported to the group events that had occurred during their rides. There are three organizations asking Bloomington to form a citizens committee to review BPD's police reports. If such a committee is formed, it seems reasonable that members of this committee should participate in training, much like what I experienced, and should take three rides with an officer to learn what it's like on the street. An old Indian proverb, never criticize a man until you have walked a mile in his moccasins. Signed, Kenneth Jesse, Normal. The next letter is titled, Hold Politicians to Higher Standard. The attempted murder of Republican congressmen at a baseball park in Alexandria, Virginia last week is truly a horrible event. It is difficult to imagine being in the situation those people on the baseball field found themselves in, desperately trying to reach the dugout or some other kind of cover and escape death. Our collective hearts go out to all those wounded in the attack. There has been much talk and discussion about what the shooting means and what we should all, as a nation, take away from this incident. Call me naive, but maybe, just maybe, if our elected officials on both sides of the aisle would start doing what they were elected to do, which is actually negotiate, collaborate, and legislate bills and laws that fairly benefit all Americans, and grow up a little bit, it would help reduce the anger and hate that obviously festers in so many citizens. What is happening to our nation is not unique. Anyone who's had a modicum of historical knowledge can see the trajectory we may be on. Wake up, folks. We must hold all of our elected officials to a much higher standard of behavior and cooperation. Signed, John J. Rader, Normal. Here's a farming story from the State and Nation page. Farmers tell Davis crop insurance vital to their survival. This is Datelined Decatur. As U.S. Representative Rodney Davis prepares to work on the next farm bill, farmers in his district stress the importance of crop insurance to their livelihood. The crop insurance is fundamentally important for risk management, said Jared Hooker, District 10 Director at the Illinois Soybean Association. The prices right now, we're basically underwater prices-wise, so we buy crop insurance, at least for our yields, and the government helps us with part of the premiums being subsidized. and that's very important for us. We all want to survive. Hooker was among about a dozen people who spent early Monday morning at the University of Illinois Extension Office at Richland Community College in Decatur to talk with Davis about the federal government's role in agriculture. The stop was just one that the Taylorville Republican is making across the 14 counties in the 13th Congressional District, which also includes much of McLean County, as lawmakers discuss ways to improve on the current farm bill. That bill, which became law in 2014, provided nearly $500 billion of federal funding overall and reformed various programs, from crop insurance funding to the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, the latter of which makes up the majority of the bill's spending. A new farm bill is generally passed every 5 years, with the current one set to expire at the end of 2018. Davis said he and others on the House Agriculture Committee will spend the rest of this year talking with constituents about the current plan and suggested changes. The hope is to have a bill ready by next year. The Farm Bill is a vehicle for us to put these policies that help our agricultural community, Davis said. Those in the audience at Richland expressed support for several of the current protections provided by the Farm Bill, specifically for agricultural research and for the federal subsidies for crop insurance premiums that Davis called the backbone of the legislation. The insurance protects farms from the loss of crops due to natural disasters, such as hail, drought, and floods, or the loss of revenue due to declines in the prices of agricultural commodities. Davis downplayed one attendee's concerns about the recent budget proposal from President Donald Trump, which called for $46.54 billion in cuts to federal funding for the agriculture sector over the next 10 years, and limiting the federal subsidies for crop insurance premiums. Congress needs to exert its privilege in improving a budget, said Davis, who added he would vote against Trump's budget as proposed. One thing that Rick Harris hopes to see in any future farm bill is a way for the federal government to make it easier for prospective farmers to enter the field. Harris, who owns 20 acres of farmland in Macon County, said there has to be a way to retain young farmers who might be stifled by the often staggering costs to maintain an operation. I don't know who the next generation is that is going to be able to afford to farm, Harris said. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Panograph for Tuesday, June 20th, 2017. Please stay tuned.